And it wouldn't have ever come for a vote if we had not.
The House Committee on Revenue for April 3rd, 2009 will come to order. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2164. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2164 pertains to the military active duty pay subtraction, and it codifies an existing Department of Revenue administrative rule that states that in the definition of active duty pay, that includes pay for weekend drills, annual training, summer camp, special school attendance, and battle assemblies. So it's just a clarification of that rule. You also have in your packet a dash one, House Bill 2164, which appears to add additional clarifying language in terms of the definitions of active and inactive duty training. And so, for example, if you're looking at the dash one, let me pull up page one of the bill. On line 19, the language would read, if the taxpayer does not qualify, starting on line 18, if the taxpayer does not qualify for the subtraction under subparagraph B of this paragraph, compensation received for active or inactive duty, active service or inactive duty training performed by a member of the Armed Forces of the United States in an amount not to exceed $6,000 per annum. And then in line 21, where it says active service, it would insert inactive duty training. So basically, the attempt is to include, to make sure that these weekend drills, annual training, summer camp, special school attendance, and battle assemblies, that those activities count, whether they're defined as inactive duty training or active duty service, they count for the subtraction.
Okay. And I tell you, what we're trying to do is square up the language in the statute with the language the military department uses.
Yes, the history of this, and I believe you'll have some testimony on that, pertains to the definition of active duty service, and it goes back a number of years, and the way the Department of Revenue has interpreted what goes into that, and that I believe the context of these activities have changed quite a bit over the years. There's been a dissidence in terms of what is included in that definition. And so in 2007, DOR instituted a temporary rule to clarify that these weekend drills and so forth were part of that definition.
Okay, great. Any questions on the introduction? No. Okay, let's hear from General Caldwell. And maybe perhaps Mr. Warnock. Warnocky?
Warnock.
Warnock would like to come up too. Welcome, General. It's always great to see you in the Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, given the circumstances the state finds itself in, I'd say this is probably one of the most important committees in the building these days, and I regret not being here almost every day, factually, but it's a pleasure to be here anyway. I think... for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Military Department. Kind of give you a little bit of background and history, I think, kind of add to what your expert staff gave you just a few seconds ago. The bill, for years, I think it's the research went back to 1951, when the state first recognized that elected to not tax a certain amount of federal pay earned by National Guard members and other reservists. That number was set at $3,000 and stayed at $3,000 until 1971, and then it was adjusted again. Some language was adjusted in 1971, because when I first cracked this thing back, I could only go to 71 because I didn't quite understand all the way to delve out history, legislative history. In 2007, the legislature elected to increase the amount of deductibility from $3,000 to $6,000. I think it was House Bill 3201 and 3202. It was melded in. You may recall, some of you that were here on the committee then, that that became the session-ending bill. It ended up starting out with one little page and ended up with 40-some pages because it turned out to be the vehicle to do a lot of different things. In the process of all of that, I think there's been an ongoing discussion and on definitions, which we're trying to do here again today, to clarify it. In our mind, when we testified in 2007, and Mr. Warnock, who's at my left and represents the Oregon War Veterans Association, was instrumental in starting this activity in 2007, and our intention, and I think our testimony indicated at the time, that terms have changed as time has gone on with respect to what we term, what we call our activities in the National Guard. The term active duty and inactive duty has been mixed and matched and used for different types of pay that you receive for doing duties. There's actually three different types of ways you can get paid as a member of the Oregon National Guard. Or a reserve component is really, the other reserve components only have essentially two ways to get paid. In the Guard, you do your weekend training assemblies, which were traditionally called inactive duty training, IDT. That was the traditional term. And you had your annual training, which was called summer camps and other different things during the years. And then the third way you could get paid is if the governor called you on state active duty and brought you in to fight a fire, a flood, or some other natural disaster, or by the call of the governor. And you can also use that for some types of training as well. So you have three methods to get paid. You have two potential sources of pay, one the federal government, two the state government. This bill was designed not to deal with the state active duty pay or make that tax-free or even a tax deduction. What it was designed to do was to give guardsmen and reservists up to $6,000 of tax relief from their earnings. The other side of this was that the other reserve components, have changed the name of what we once called weekend drills or inactive duty. They now call those battle assemblies. So in essence, what happened in 2007 was when we changed the term, and it was interpreted by the Department of Revenue that weekend training assemblies were actually inactive duty training, which is how the department reviewed it, and I'm not suggesting that was necessarily wrong from their viewpoint, but it certainly was. It changed the scheme because now you've got all the other reserve components, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard. Those reserve components would be under battle assemblies and therefore would be tax exempt, where a guardsman who works for the governor and works for you is under your control and the power of the governor, on the other hand, would not be tax exempt from that earning. So simply by those terms, we ended up with a situation where we were actually given a tax benefit to reservists who have no connection to the state other than they happen to live here, but they may, and they do their duties here, most of them, but they're not under the call of the governor where the guard is. So we had discussions with the Department of Revenue. They recognized at that point that, indeed, I think the intention, I'm not going to speak for them, but certainly we presented our argument, which was the intent, we believe, of the 2007 legislative body was to move all of this types of duty pay into this $6,000 exemption. If it wasn't there before, then we wanted to make sure that it was clear that it was there now. And I don't think the language necessarily told them that that's exactly what they should do. They erred on our side, I guess, on the side of the guardsmen and said, or if they did err, but they chose to go to the side of the guardsmen to say, well, we're going to take the liberal interpretation and consider all that pay in a temporary rule now, but we want to get this fixed during this session so it's absolutely crystal clear to everybody and we don't have this discussion again. That's the intent and the purpose of House Bill 2164. As your staff has just indicated, there's an amendment that does, again, I think, further clarify, and there may be better language that we could use, perhaps not, to even make it more clear. And I know Mr. Warnock is going to suggest something. So that's kind of the background. That's kind of the history as we understand it, as we believe it to be. And we believe that, that the intent here is to get to a point where it's non-debatable that if you receive pay from the federal government under your duty as a guardsman or a reservist in this state, that the first $6,000 of that pay is non-taxable by the state of Oregon. That is the goal. That is the direction we want to get there. So I will conclude my testimony, and I'd be happy to attempt to answer any questions you may have.
Are there questions at this point for General Caldwell? Yes, Representative Berger.
I appreciate him coming here, and I can tell you, you sincerely regret that you can't be here every morning. It's a thrill a minute. But I know you have better things to do, General.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I you know, I know how difficult these sessions are, and I, after hearing today that the 30% reductions are coming on the website of LFO, I'm thinking this is going to be one of the most important committees in this building because you guys got a tremendous task ahead of you.
Thank you.
And here I am asking for, you know. So.
Well, it seems as though what you're asking for is a clarification of the rules. So
yes, sir.
It makes it easier to administer. I have a couple of questions. What typically is the compensation of a guardsman in these circumstances that we're describing here under paragraph A?
Chair Barnhart, it varies. Obviously, there's different pay scales for different individuals. We typically estimate that the average mid-ranked enlisted person is going to earn somewhere around that $6,500, $7,000 a year. Your typical mid-rank captain major is going to earn somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 to $14,000 a year. So, in essence, the majority of the benefit is going to go toward the enlisted, the lower-ranked individuals. Several years ago, and it's been probably 20 years ago now, I hate to admit that, but we actually asked Oregon State University to do some analysis on what they called then the input-output studies. You may recall some of that that went along in the counties, and they did a lot of this work at the county level. We said, what does this money do in the economy? And they came back, and it was hard to track, but they theorized that because the money is not a large enough sum that people would make like a house payment on it, they typically are going to use it in the service economy for dinners, movies, you know, that sort of discretionary spending as opposed to hard goods. So they said, you know, this is really a good type of income because it stays in the community and rolls more often than, say, you buy a car, you spend it one time, and then it goes to Detroit, or overseas, wherever that thing was manufactured, that car, whereas this kind of money goes in, is spent in the local main street, if you will, and gets more nicks around than the typical large payment does. So we found that interesting, we found that fascinating, we thought that that is a good thing for communities because it isn't a lot of money, but it does add to that individual's ability to have a little extra cash.
Now, Mr. Warnock may be planning to talk about this issue, but it seems to me that it's a pretty clumsy mechanism for us to be changing the language in the statute every time the military decides to use a different word to describe the same activity. You indicated that they don't call it weekend drill anymore; they call it battle assembly.
Crap.
Well, I mean, it seems to me we ought to have language that would allow them to call it FUBAR, and it would still work.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's precisely the right solution, because as I indicated, the way the statute actually read after the 2007, if you were an Army reservist or one of the other reserve component reservists, you do battle assemblies now. Wasn't in the statute, so to the average, unless you're a military person, which, you know, there aren't a lot of them typically in the revenue department, I don't know of any, frankly, and doing that sort of thing, then you got to draw an interpretation based on something you really don't have any background on. So
right.
I agree. I think the simpler, the better.
Now, these battle schools or weekend assemblies, weekend drills or summer camp and so forth, those are all required by whom?
Mr. Chairman, when you join the reserve components, the National Guard in our case, you're required to do what they term 48 drill assemblies per year. Those are broken out over a four-hour periods over 12 months, obviously, and 15 days of what is termed annual training. That's the old advertisement, you know, 1 week in a month, 2 weeks in the summer, and the best part-time job in America. I suggest some people would argue it probably isn't any longer, but nevertheless, that was how it was termed. So the average person is going to do, typically, even with the deployments, we do 1 weekend drill per month, and we do a 2 week annual training. So we still call them weekend training assemblies, no longer call them inactive duty training. We call them weekend training assemblies now, WEDAs. So, again, it's the reserves, on the other hand, changed the term and said, no, we're going to call them battle assemblies. And, I don't know who's – I've been in the Pentagon many, many times, and someday I'm going to find the room where the guys sit around and dream this stuff up and come up with these acronyms. There's got to be a big call in there someplace where that's all they do, because I swear it's every 6 months you get a new term. And I think that's, kind of the way of a lot of bureaucracies is you got to put your stamp on it that I was there, and so when I was in charge of this, I changed the term, and that's your legacy, I guess. But they'll continue to change. They've changed at least three times in my 38 years in this organization, so I would tell you that there's more to come.
Well, if it makes any difference on actual attendance, then that's whatever that is, that word name is, you should use that name. Otherwise, it doesn't matter a whole lot, does it?
No, sir, it doesn't. But I think that we're very fortunate in the state of Oregon. We've always had, we've always been close to the top, if not on the top, with respect to our attendance, our strength levels, even when times were bad around the country. And there were certain states that couldn't get members, couldn't recruit them. We were always, kind of pushing the top, and now we're exceeding all the goals, and I think who knows what the reasoning is. I'm sure the economy's got a lot to do with it right now, but even 2 years ago we were exceeding the goals. So Oregon is, for whatever reason, and perhaps maybe since we don't have a large military presence and no major base here in this state, that we're the main game in town, and we've got 40 different sites throughout the state, and we've been very fortunate. So,
okay. And I assume that if someone misses the time that they're supposed to be there, they don't get paid for that.
That's correct.
Thank you. Mr. Warnick?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes, Representative Crawley.
Thank you. I have one quick question. My concern is very much like the chair's. Are we going to get I just don't want to continue to be inconsistent with whatever the federal government decides to define things as. So I would really like to see that. And I just like to point out that I think the chair is now the putative author of the FUBA amendment. So that's that might be your legacy, sir.
I might just add one more thing for just general edification here, is that the term, terms are different to everybody, obviously. And I think that's the business you're in, is trying to define those so people can understand them and do the work that the government needs to do. If you're in the active duty service, you're termed active duty. If you're inactive duty, then that can mean different things to different services. Inactive duty to the active duty military means, in many respects, that you're in the reserve component. And that could be termed inactive duty. In our case, we look at inactive duty because when you join the National Guard, you have a six-year commitment. Total commitment, though, is 8 years. But 6 years of that is active, is what we term active. The last two are inactive. And inactive means that you sit in we have a shelf we place records on that said this is the inactive National Guard, the ING. They don't drill, they don't get paid, but we can still reach out and pull them back to service if we need those individuals for like these deployments that are coming up. We have not done that. We haven't done it even in these deployments in that we've needed people. So when you get into these terms with every, you know, it's kind of in the eye of the beholder or the organization you're in, whereas the active service, the active duty folks would say, wait a minute, no, you guys in the Guard, even though you're drilling and getting paid, you're in the inactive. And then we say, no, we're active. The inactive guys are sitting over here waiting that two-year period from their enlistment. So that's why I think terminology is so vital that we make it clear, because I know I can pick up the phone right now and call somebody at the Defense Pay System and say, what does inactive duty mean to you? And they're going to give me a different interpretation.
So, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So is it your thinking that they're called battle assemblies now, we leave it in here as battle assemblies, and if it changes, that term changes down the road a piece, you'll just come back in and we'll change the statute to try to make sure that it's always as clear as possible?
And then Mr. Chairman,
or do you think that there's a way to make it more clear right now? So
yeah,
we
I think we got an
again.
Opportunity now with this vehicle to make it absolutely crystal clear, and I think I would try to get away from inactive duty, active duties, every other kind of duties. I think we ought to be able to come up with some terminology that says if you're drawing a paycheck and you're working for the Oregon Guard or any reserve component, or for that matter, the active duty military, you get $6,000 worth of tax deduction in the state of Oregon, period. Now, I don't know what the right terminology is for that, and I'm going to let Greg talk. I'm trying to steal his information.
Okay.
He may
you.
Clarify his suggestion.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Greg Warnock, Oregon War Veterans Association. Also for the record, I would like to say that 8 o'clock money meeting should be illegal. This is crazy.
There are a number of us who agree with that.
Wow. I thought you had more pull, Mr. Chair, to get a better time slot. Thank you for hearing us today. This is an important bill. Also, by the way, there's a mirror bill in the Senate side, 924. We didn't know this bill was being presented by the governor's office, so we drafted Senate Bill 924, and it's not yet been amended to speak the language that we intended. But we could actually drop that bill and fix it here if you would prefer to do that. Keep in mind the reason why we've come before you is because revenue, the Department of Revenue, has decided or determined that the language in the statute was not sufficient. And in fact, it was so insufficient that they initially declined to provide that benefit or that deduction that we passed in 2007. And it was only after several conversations, a couple of them kind of heated, that we came up with a temporary rule to allow the National Guard troops and the reservists in Oregon to receive the deduction for 2007-2008. And we are very appreciative of Department of Revenue's work on that. The language was so controversial that they actually had, that Revenue actually had to go to DOJ and come up with permission to allow for the deduction in 2007-2008. So they came to us and asked us to help them prepare language and put a bill in place that would fix it permanently. Frankly, this will work on a temporary basis. Next session, it probably wouldn't work. If we want a permanent fix, we need different language. If we want a solution just to make sure the revenue has the ability to set administrative rules that apply to the National Guard troops and reservists, this would function perfectly this time. Frankly, and keep in mind the reason why we're doing this, too, is we've got a lot of people in service that are working hard. 3,500 of them are going to be in Iraq here in the next couple of months. It's the biggest deployment of Oregon troops since World War II. And, I mean, that's huge. Think about World War II. That was a world war. And we have as many people going to war from Oregon Citizens Army that we did in World War II currently. So the reason why this is so important is to take care of our guys and our gals in service, but we need to do something to fix this language so Revenue has the ability to do their work. There's only one way that active or inactive or partly active member of the military gets paid, and it's through a federal paycheck. And they get a W-2. for that paycheck every year. And it's our recommendation that we develop language that says basically W-2 compensation, earned or paid for, a W-2 written by or paid for, a check written by, paid for by the agency or organization that writes those checks, is the permanent solution. General Caldwell knows the agency name that writes the paychecks, but it's one organization that writes that check. They always have, they always will. I think that's a permanent fix. Just make it a simple W-2 compensation solution, and we've got this fix for the bill. I'm a little unclear on that because I don't remember the name of the agency that writes that check.
Mr. Chairman, the agency is the Defense Accounting System, or we call it DFAS. I guess the other thing that I would say in the amendment, we're back to the active inactive service, and I think if I was going to adjust this and go stay with those terms as opposed to what Greg has recommended here, and maybe it's both is what you need, I would say drop the word active and put or inactive and just say service, because service is service.
If I could, Mr. Chair, what we would recommend is W-2 compensation, line 19 of the bill, page 1, line 19, right after the word graph, to insert the word term W-2 compensation, and then later in that same line, received for service performed by a member of the armed services. That, to us, satisfies that issue. I don't know if Deborah will agree with that, if they have a different solution or another option for that. We may have to put in a DFAS or the Defense Accounting System, W-2, or something like that to work for them, but somehow we have to simplify this.
So it's your contention then that if we simply leave out the word active, that might take care of the problem. I suspect, let me ask a couple of questions in aid of that, and then perhaps you can work with the department to see whether this sort of an amendment might work. It occurred, I wonder if the Defense Accounting System pays people for anything else other than service under these circumstances.
Mr. Chairman, no.
So if someone had a different federal job, they'd get a different paycheck from someone else.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And they have the statute already indicates that retired pay is not part of this. So it is service pay, and when you're not in the service, you're obviously wouldn't qualify. So any type of service in any of the armed forces would then qualify that.
Mr. Chair, and also then on line 22, the dark portion would be removed then. It's unnecessary.
Well, I'm not sure that I wouldn't leave it just as further definition.
So
personally, but I think the more definition you can get here, the better off you are, so that subsequent people, as they turn over and move on, it's really clear.
I don't really want to draft the bill in the public hearing.
Yes, sir.
But it's very important to get these concepts understood. Representative Riley.
Are we going to hear from Revenue?
If you want to. Revenue's here.
Yes, I would like for them to tell us their feeling and what they think the language might be. And
Ms. Buchanan, do you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, while she's coming out, let me just say that we didn't come here to try to redraft the bill today. This would be sufficient as written.
Well,
but the question's coming from the committee posed.
Well, let me just say a couple of things about that, and then we'll let the Department of Revenue talk a little bit. I've looked at the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 is not complete because this bill actually repeats the statute for reasons I don't remember, but I know they're important. And the second place where that amendment appears on page 4, there's no change that's been made. So if we're going to adopt the Dash 1, we'd have to adopt another amendment to take care of that identical language on page 4. So we're not ready to and of course we don't have the bill scheduled to work today anyway, so we're not going to work the bill today. So we might as well get the thing squared away, get it the way we want it, draft the amendment to get it the way we want it, since we have to draft another amendment anyway, and get it so that it actually works. And I would prefer not to have this come back. It's great to see General Caldwell, but I'd like to see it for some other reason next time. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. You've heard some of the history and the background on how this is before you. When the department attempted to implement the $6,000 change from the 2007 session, we received indeed some constructive criticism from the military department, from the War Veterans Association, from the governor's office, from several members of the legislature about our interpretation of the law and our response.
I suspect that's true, yes.
Yes, sir.
In fact, I think I remember some of that.
Yes. Our response to the comments was that's the way we've always done it. And, in fact, that was the way we had always done it. We were able to go back to 1953, where we found the exact same words in the statute, the same $3,000 subtraction. And we had consistently interpreted that in the same way for those 50-plus years. It occurred to us that perhaps the legislature in 2007, in making the increase, had a different concept in mind from the legislature that enacted that in the first place. So the comments that we received seemed plausible to us, and that was the reason that we adopted the temporary rule with the assurance that the legislature would give us some policy direction on the matter. And that is why we are here now, is to get that policy direction from you. I think probably this wasn't an issue before, because many people probably hit the $3,000 cap, not taking into account the weekend drill and annual training pay. So it never became an issue for them. They were already at the maximum amount. The other point that I wanted to make is that we would be happy to work on clarifying this provision. One thing I do want to point out is that there are a number of subtractions or deductions available to members of the military, not just this one, and we do want to make sure that all of those fit. It seems to me that one of the things that could be done in the interim is to look at all of these different provisions and come back to the legislature with a comprehensive proposal that puts in one place all of the different subtractions that apply. For example, this one is for active service. You'll notice in on line 24 of the bill, there's a deduction for active duty. Elsewhere in the law, there are deductions available for military service, which may be something different. I don't know. There's a subtraction for active duty pay earned outside the state until the end of combat is declared in the Persian Gulf. That came from the Gulf War.
Right.
And yet, so all of these things don't necessarily fit together neatly. One concern that we would have is that whatever we do with this, it doesn't cause something unintended for those other deductions that are available. But we'd be happy to work on language if you'd like us to do that.
Is it possible in the time that we're likely to have to do that comprehensive look? I mean, I think the intent, based on our past history, and of course others might disagree with me, which is, it's dangerous to say this, but I think our intent was that those who are in the situations that the general has described would get a deduction for $6,000. That those who were serving overseas wouldn't pay taxes in Oregon.
They don't know.
And of course, they make more than $6,000, one presumes, because they're being paid full-time. But I don't think it was our intent that these would accumulate in the same year.
That's right.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, any pay earned outside the state of Oregon is currently tax-exempt, military pay. It is federally taxed, but it's not taxed by the state of Oregon if it's outside. Most of this type of pay, when we have people doing weekend training assemblies and annual trainings, is done inside the state. However, as an example, all of our Eastern Oregon units train at Gowan Field. So when they do weekend assemblies in Gowan Field, because that's where their tanks are, and that's where they have to be, then that income is non-taxable for that weekend training assembly, whereas a counterpart may have stayed back and worked in one of their units, and that is taxable.
Where is Gowan Field?
Gowan Field, I'm sorry, is in Boise, Idaho.
Is in Idaho.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they go to Gowan Field outside of Boise, and yet if you happen to be across the river in Representative Bence's Armory in Ontario, and your boss said, you stay here and count widgets for the weekend, we're going across the river to do our weekly training, our weekend training, then that guy technically has to pay taxes on his drill pay, where the other guy that went across the river does not, because he earned it over there. So that's kind of the situation.
He may owe something to Idaho, huh?
Well, most folks, I think, about south of Baker consider themselves in Idaho anyway. So, and I don't mean that as it's a reality. But all members of the militia and the reserve components who earn pay in a war zone, that's both state and federally tax exempt as well. So once they depart, in our case, the 3,000 members, they will leave Fort Stewart, Georgia, around the first of July, end of June. So every penny they earn after that is tax exempt. Every penny they earned at Fort Stewart, Georgia is federally taxed, but not state taxed.
Mm-hmm.
So Deborah's correct. There are several exemptions throughout the statutes that apply to military members, but those are the ones that, and we, as you recall, when you were on the Veterans Committee, the state created an ad valorem tax or a property tax exemption, which we found in our best intentions couldn't be initiated, if you remember. So some of this stuff ends up good intentions, as she's indicated, but they don't seem to get realized because of the technicalities of it. So, but generally speaking, I think I would agree again with Deborah that we need to probably do most of this in the interim to take a look at the whole thing. But I think we need to fix this now, get it moved on so we don't have the problems that we had during the past interim, and then look at the other possible solutions to meld them together and see where we've got conflicts.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. if we do this, what's being suggested, we really don't need any amendments to the bill as it sits currently, because another bill will be coming next term and fix all of the problems, hopefully. So we don't really need any amendments if we do that, what's being suggested.
Ah.
Is that correct, Deborah?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the amendment that we have was to clearly provide, and the General can help me with this, I think, that the active service, that term may more appropriately be inactive duty training. If weekend drills are not considered active service, then the language in the bill may not be exactly...
Well, of course, we can make any word mean whatever we want.
Yes, you can.
Oh, we're the legislative power. We get to do that. And we've defined active service to include weekend drills, annual training, summer camp, special school attendance, and battle assemblies in this language.
Mr. Chair, you make an excellent point. Thank you.
I think that's Representative Riley's point.
Yeah.
All right.
You have, exactly.
Well, that would deal with the immediate problem. It doesn't deal with the accumulation and rewrite of the tax law relating to service people. I think his implication is that that's not something we ought to try to do in this bill or this session.
I agree, Mr. Chair. I think it takes a concentrated effort and time.
All right. So perhaps what we need to do is set up an interim work group to prepare something like that, get it to the Veterans Affairs Committee if we have one next session, and then see if we want what we want to do with it from there. Or maybe not even go to them. Maybe just bring it back here because, after all, it's related to tax issues. We wouldn't be changing any policy. We'd simply be rewriting the statute so that it worked better.
Correct.
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Anything else this morning? If we were to go that route, then the bill doesn't require amendment. If we understand that it's only a temporary fix until somebody comes up with a new name for a battle assembly.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2164? I don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2164 and open a work session on House Bill 3411. And that's yours also, isn't it? And what I'd like to do this morning on this bill is I'd like to go through the amendments that we have. I'd like to talk about them and the bill in some detail so we can get some guidance on where you'd like to go. The bill is not ready to work today because there are pieces that we still don't have. But this thing is getting rapidly more complicated, and I would like to see if we can't reduce the complexity a little bit. And we have an hour, so let's go at it. Would you go through the amendments for us and describe where we are? I think a couple of them we can, or at least one of them we can discard because it isn't going to work. And then, if you'll help us with that, that would be good.
Okay. Mr. Chair, in your packet, you've got, or the last time this was heard, you received four amendments, -1 through -4. And today in your packet, there are a -5 and a -6. So perhaps if we just walk through them numerically.
Yeah. And pause after each one in case there's discussion about it.
Yes. Well, starting off, you can discard the -1. That there was a mistake in that, and that is now the -5, so we'll get to that. So you can discard the -1.
Okay, that reduces the complexity.
Mm-hmm. The -2, the key language in the -2 is on page 5 of the amendment in lines 6 through 9. And what this does is add electric vehicle manufacturing to the renewable manufacturing facilities credit. Under existing law, to qualify for that credit, it would have to be a renewable manufacturing facility. So the electric vehicle manufacturers wouldn't fit into that. So this simply adds that to that credit.
Mr. Graney, this is not a topic we've actually talked about in the committee before, if I recall. I do recall that it's part of the governor's proposal.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, good morning. Mike Graney from Department of Energy. I think the last time I testified, I mentioned this perhaps briefly, and just went through it very quickly, but the intent was to afford manufacturers of electric vehicles and electric vehicle equipment the same incentive that solar manufacturing facilities have. This is something that our Department of Economic Development supports very strongly in its job recruitment efforts. These facilities employ comparable numbers as the solar manufacturers, and they're under active discussions right now with a couple of the major electric vehicle manufacturers. And what I'm passing out, by the way, we've done at least an initial rough cut of the estimated revenue savings from the different amendments, including House Bill 3411 plus the other amendments here that we've discussed that I can walk you through when you'd like at an appropriate time.
Okay. Yes, Representative Brent.
Strange question, but as most of my are, but would this exclude other vehicle technologies that are renewable, say fuel cell, hydrogen fuel cell vehicle? Not that I think there's any knocking on the door to manufacture here, but would we be picking favorites and excluding others that would fall under renewable?
Those are electric vehicles, aren't they?
I don't know. I mean, that's maybe a technical question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brun, yes, they are. We consider them electric vehicles, although I think your question raises a good point. We may want to take another look at that language to see if that's encompasses potential technologies there, but the emphasis really is on facilities that would create lots of jobs and clean technology.
So now, in the area where I live, I don't think specifically in my district, but nearby, there are a couple of startup companies that are trying to manufacture small electric cars.
Yes.
That's the kind of company that would qualify under this provision, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, they would. They probably would not hit the dollar limit of the increased incentive because those are the smaller vehicles, in some cases the three-wheel vehicles or four-wheel that have limited speeds. We had in mind here, and the economic development has in mind, is the large vehicles that could be run fully on the highways, just like any other vehicles. But those, the ones you mentioned, would qualify as well. It's just that they probably don't have the same kind of cost in terms of capital cost.
When you say the dollar limit, what do you mean?
The $40 million limit.
Oh, no, I don't think they're going to hit that.
No, but they would qualify, and they would also qualify under for the use of those purchase of those vehicles under both the residential and business energy tax credit, and with some changes that are in another bill that would potentially increase that incentive.
And that's a bill that's not before this committee.
Not yet. That's House Bill 2180.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Berger and then Representative Call.
Mike, why would they qualify under residential?
Chairman, Representative Berger, for individuals who purchase those vehicles.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking
of the guy in the back shop trying to develop them.
No.
Okay.
That's
Thank
correct.
You.
I was These talking about
customers.
The purchase.
Yeah.
After the manufacturer.
Okay, got it.
Users.
Yeah.
Representative Call?
Yeah, my question is around the language, but not including components that may be used in both electric and conventional vehicles. I guess my question is around the real cutting-edge part of the development of electric vehicles is batteries, and it seems to me that we would love to have some of that research and development and business in our state, but batteries could be used in either a conventional car, a hybrid car, or an electric car. I'm wondering if we want to be a bit more specific there. Can you talk to me about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Call, the batteries we're talking about are specific for electric vehicles, so it's not the normal car battery, normal car battery technology. So the line does get gray sometimes between whether it's hybrids or all electric or alternative fuel vehicles and normal vehicles, and we try to be able to pull that incremental cost out, and so that the state's not funding just standard practices. That's the intent there, and we probably need to clarify that in rulemaking.
Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Director Graney. I remember some of the conversation we've had about House Bill 2180 in the other committee, and my recollection is that some of the language associated with electric vehicles there gives the department more authority to deal with market conditions and when the acceptance of various technologies happens, so that it could be a bit more flexible. Is there is there reason to think about adding that language here, or does it make more sense to keep it in a separate vehicle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, in that case, in House Bill 2180, we're talking again about the users, purchasers of the vehicles. Here, with the manufacturing facilities, there are benchmarks that are required for the solar and other renewable manufacturers already. Those comparable provisions would apply to large facilities that make electric vehicles or vehicle components.
That's our 2008 change, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman.
Thank you.
Other things on... Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Directors, do we have a number or an estimate of the cost of this particular provision? In other words, has anybody approached the department that's in this business and said, we're anxious to bring a large facility here and blah, blah, blah?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz. And the primary discussions have actually been with the Department of Economic Development, although they've involved us. But we've the chart that I just handed out. The bottom line there before the total is the amendment that is the impact of the Dash 2 amendment, and that's the only one that does increase revenue impacts. So, you know, we estimate $1.82 million for the next biennium, and then increasing for a couple of biennium and dropping back down. I do want to mention that on all these estimates, they are just that. They're just estimates based on assumptions that we make and that we share with the committee staff. We're more confident about the near-term estimates than the long-term, but we do think that this would have a relatively small impact compared to the existing both solar manufacturing and to the revenue reductions that the other measures would have.
Although, Mr. Chairman, the reason I, of course, ask is because of our difficult budget situation, and $2 million would appear to be small, but I guess I'm curious about the speed at which someone could appear on the horizon, and then suddenly we would have a demand for the $10 or $11 million number. So, can you share with us how long it generally takes these kind of things to happen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have active discussions going on now, and sometimes decisions can be made quickly. But the tax credit isn't issued until the project is complete. So the plant has to be built if it's a manufacturing facility. And then the tax credit is taken over 5 years, so that is why in any given year the revenue impact might be smaller than you would expect, say, for a facility that size. And that's why we've done the estimates over five biennium there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else right now on the Dash 2? Let's go ahead to the Dash 3 then.
Okay, the Dash 3 amendment is the one pertaining to grants received from the Energy Trust. And right now, it basically adds grants received from the Energy Trust. Any of those grants get removed from the certified costs. So if a taxpayer gets a $1,000 grant from the Energy Trust, in terms of totaling up their certified costs, which are then eligible, that's the basis for the tax credit, those certified costs would be reduced by that $1,000. So it's a way of reducing the tax credit.
And if you'll recall, colleagues, we had some testimony about that at the last hearing that we held, or it may have been the last work session, I'm not sure. Mr. Grady, did you want to be heard on this one?
Mr. Chairman, just to mention that the estimated revenue savings from that particular measure is the fourth line on this chart that I provided. So we estimate about $11 million in the 2009-11 biennium for that measure. It's where it says incremental impact of eligible project costs reduced to amount of ETL or Energy Trust incentives.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, it's my memory that the gentleman from Eastern Oregon, whose name I don't recall, said that for small projects, this was a really important piece.
Yeah.
And I wonder, were you here, and would you like to talk about that, Director?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I was. Paul Wooden mentioned that, and I think that is a valid concern. But this provision, as currently drafted, would apply to all projects. You could potentially set a dollar limit that would apply to, or a size limit. In the case of wind projects, you're looking at about $2 million a megawatt. So if it's a 10-megawatt project, that's over, the $5 million threshold that 3411 generally applies to. So you would want to look at, I think, a different threshold there if you wanted to do something like that. That would reduce the revenue impact, but you'd still have revenue impact savings, or reduce the savings, right?
Yes, please.
I guess I'd like to I remember specifically Mr. Wooden's map and what's going on, sort of this entrepreneurial look at energy solutions around the state, and I guess as long as we're talking amendments, I I would suggest that Mr. Graney, who's more aware of these projects than I am, consider some sort of a limit instead of just a blanket, Energy Trust grant thing, put a limit on the size of the project that's eligible for this. In other words, something that would encourage these small projects to go forward in, well, they were throughout the state, and I think that's one of the things that I liked it. And people are thinking creatively about alternative energy and how we can use some of our resources, and it was pretty clear from his testimony that the Energy Trust piece is huge. And these were not big projects. They weren't big bucks things. So if Mr. Graney would noodle on that and come forward with some useful suggestions, I would deeply appreciate it.
I think you're suggesting that a project below a certain size, this would not apply to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Instead of a blanket, mm-hmm. all projects, it would be... Mm-hmm.
Right. Do you think you could look into that and come back with a suggestion that would keep us part of this revenue, but also protect the issues that I think it was the county judge was, or the county, one of the commissioners was talking right. about.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we can work on that and give you some options there.
All right. Thank you. Anything else on the dash three for now? Dash fours? Yes, Representative Benz.
I had a question about what labeled the dash three amendment that was handed out some time ago. So it seemed as though we had two dash three amendments.
Well, yes. If you'll note, that one was on a different bill. And on 2472, what we're looking at now is the one on 3411. And I've just realized that I don't have it, or I've put it aside or something. There it is. Well, that was the dash three. Yeah. That was the dash three on a different bill, and that was.
What has it now become, or is it?
Well, I don't think we have it yet.
Okay.
I think they were drafting it.
It's the AFL's recommendation.
It's the AFL's recommendation, and I don't believe we've received an amendment to this bill that contains that data, that
okay.
information.
Thank you.
Yeah. So now we'll talk about the dash four.
Okay. The dash four. The key language there is on page two. Lines 19 and 20, and it's a deletion.
Oh, this is the 10% add-on that we're
yes,
removing.
Yes, Mr.
Chair. Correct. Right.
Yes.
We didn't discuss this a lot. I do recall Senator Burdick and I discussed it, and this seemed like an approach to us that would reduce our costs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And it's the difference between the cost we certify and preliminary certification before construction begins and the actual certified cost after completion. And the developer is allowed a 10% difference in the course of construction and completion of the project. This would remove that 10%, and the estimated savings there is the second line of this chart. So, again, another approximately $10 million of revenue reduction.
And of course, it looks like it accelerates pretty fast into future biennia, too.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes, Representative
you pointed out last time we met on this that there's actually certain projects that would, because of this 10% wiggle room, would actually put them over the maximum allowable under statute. So there's, and tell me the dollar level, but...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, that's correct. We've had projects that are pre-certified at $20 million, for example, large wind projects, other projects, and because of this 10%, they can actually receive a credit based on $22 million eligible cost.
So
this
your interpretation of the current law is that the actual cap is 11.
Yes, Mr. Chairman,
rather
11
than
million
10.
Dollars of credit. That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
So this gets it back to the 10 we thought we were doing.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Brent Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question is,
yes, it will.
I personally am in favor of the amendment. I'm just curious if it will have any, in your opinion, negative impact upon the original idea, which was to incent these projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, I think all of these will have some impact. In normal times, I wouldn't be recommending any of these to you, particularly the one that reduces the maximum cost from $20 million to $10 million. That was a high point of our legislative package last session. But given the serious economic situation we're in, I think these are changes which would still provide a reasonable incentive, better incentive than many states have for renewable energy. And there may be some projects that don't go forward because of that or get delayed. I think that's unfortunately a likely outcome.
Yes, Representative.
Now, when you say that, you're not talking about the 10%. You're talking about the 20, 40 to 20?
Well, I think all of these. I think any of these measures, I know I have heard concern about each of these individually from people, and you probably have too, depending on, you know, what their situation is. But I think these are better alternatives than some of the ones that have been proposed and considered.
Yes, please.
It seems to me that because of the way it was crafted, it was almost an automatic increase of 10%, as opposed to the original intent of the device, which was to maybe take into account some oversight or failure to identify a problem in the original bid. And that is one thing, but it seems to me, given the fact that I think in our discussions in the work group, like 90% or 95% of the folks were going into the 10%, or at least a very substantial number. And that would tend to suggest we're actually creating an $11 million device as opposed to a 10, with every once in a while going over the 10. So am I correctly capturing the explanation of what actually was going on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, yes, I believe so for many of the large projects, yes.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Greeney, I'm just trying to wrap my head a little bit around some of the trade-offs in the Dash 4, and actually perhaps Representative Bruin, being in the construction industry, can help me understand this as well a little bit. So the original intention of the 10% was that in the pre-certification, it's sometimes difficult to estimate what the total final cost of a project is going to be. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, that's correct, especially for projects that might take, that are very large, might take more than a year to complete. I think for installing lighting in a business or heating changes, small projects, we don't see that much of a cost increase. We'll see some sometimes, but it's mostly on the larger projects.
Yes, please.
And so for the larger projects, then, now the consideration will be that the pre-certification, there's an increased emphasis that this needs to be as accurate as possible, and that if a large facility, especially, it sounds like, perceives that there is future variability, that they might be less interested in pursuing that investment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, I don't know how much of a disincentive in terms of dissuading somebody from going forward. If there are, say, unusual circumstances that come up, an applicant does under current law, and I think would continue to have the option to amend their pre-cert. So that would give us the opportunity to review again what's the cause of those costs, increased costs, and see if they qualify rather than simply having an automatic 10% come in when the project's completed. And also then your cap, your project cap clearly would override any, that would be the absolute limit. So it would go from $11 million to $10 million. We wouldn't have $11 million certified costs.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Your last answer was very interesting to me because it introduced a new piece of information, at least for me. Maybe everybody else knew this. So in the when you pre-certify, if your actual costs end up exceeding the pre-certified limit, then there is a process by which you can return and say, please change the pre-certification estimate because of the following unanticipated factors. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, that's correct. We could take that into account.
So this then, the effect of this amendment sounds like then that it is not removing the accounting for variability in economic conditions, market conditions, whatever. Rather, it takes it from an automatic grant of an overrun up to 10% to a default of a review by the department for all potential overruns. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, that's correct, and it also effectively clarifies that the project limiting statute overrides the 10% variability that was there. And that's where the revenue savings comes from in that particular case.
I think one of the things to note is that the way we handle the Betsy, it has a much greater effect on smaller projects than it does on big ones. A project which is going to cost $200 million, the maximum Betsy change of $1 or $2 million is far less important than it is on a project which has an expected total cost of $10 million. And so it's one of these funny situations in which the whatever we do, the effect's larger on smaller projects unless they fall underneath some kind of a cap. And I think it's very much like Representative Berger's observation on the other amendment we were discussing a minute ago. So I think that's something that we have to keep in our minds as we work on these, is that for very, very large projects, the Betsy is a relatively small item, relatively smaller than it is for on smaller projects. Representative Berger.
Which, thank you, Mr. Chair, leads me to remind the committee that the purpose of the Betsy is to get projects, and the bigger the project, the more impact it's going to have. So, in our efforts here to save revenue, which is, I think, what we're about, we are also constraining our ability to get these big projects that have a big impact. And so I'm just putting that back on the table to remember what we're really talking about here. Thank you, right. Mr. Chair.
And I think that's a critically important observation. Given the way we are managing, the way we are structuring incentives, I don't believe there's any way that this committee can avoid dealing with this issue for a long time to come. I would be astounded if whatever we come up with here is the final statement. Because of the way we handle incentives at all, we are in effect trying to manage the amount of money that's needed in order to get projects to the stage at which they produce a profit for the developer or the operator or both without spending more than we have to. And I think that my belief is that this system is a fairly clumsy one for doing that. I wish we were using a different mechanism. This is the one we are using. We're certainly not in a position this year to make changes in the whole system because it requires more than we know now to do that. This is, in my belief at least, is a creature of the observation that I've made several times before of the disconnect between the revenue raising process in the legislature and the budget ways and means process in the legislature, along with some of the other disconnects that come about because of the way we're organized. And as long as that's true, I think we're stuck with fine-tuning this thing. I would be astounded if this were the final version, whatever we come up with. I think we're going to be looking at it in 10. I think we're going to be looking at it in 11. I don't think there's any way of avoiding dealing with this. The other issue, of course, the other key issue, of course, is that we have got to make the transition to a renewable energy economy. Right. That is, I think everyone I've talked to agrees that that has to happen. And the technology is developing so fast, and the economic changes are occurring so fast, that we will probably be playing catch-up for many years to come in the process. And we want to stay far enough ahead of the curve so that the wave doesn't come crashing down on us. Instead, we can ride it. And you have another comment.
Well, I don't want to be argumentative, Mr. And we're kind of off the subject of these amendments, Mr. Chair, but mm-hmm. I think that you call it a crude tool. I would say that what we are talking about today is the success of this tool. If it hadn't uh-huh. been used as much as it is to bring renewable things into our portfolio, we wouldn't be having this discussion at all.
That's correct.
So yep. I think in some sense I'm dismayed that we are in some sense talking about dismantling something that has been successful.
Yeah.
And brought a lot to our renewable portfolio, and that's what it was designed for, and I would say it has been successful. And I'm dismayed by this discussion, frankly. So I just, mm-hmm. we need to go on, but I just...
Thank you. No, I appreciate the comment. I would agree with a part of what you said. I think that rather than the word dismantle, I would use the term fine-tune.
Okay. Well,
thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Anything else on the Dash 4? Let's go on. Dash 5.
Okay, the Dash 5 is the corrected Dash 1.
So let's talk about what that actually does.
Okay, now it helps to take this and line it up with the bill because it just refers to deleting language and so forth. So the Dash 5 makes changes to the draft bill on page 2. And if you look at lines 15 through 19, those are the three categories of projects that exist under current law in terms of caps. There is a $40 million cap for the renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities, the solar worlds and so forth. There's a $20 million cap for projects pertaining to producing renewable energy, kind of the wind farms. And then on line 19, everything else, there's a $10 million cap. So what the policy in the Dash 5 does is eliminate or change those projects that are currently subject to a $20 million cap to a $10 million cap. And the way that the Dash 5s achieve that is by deleting lines 15 and 16 and then just renumbering or re-lettering the A's and B's. Mm-hmm. So basically, you have $40 million for the renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities and $10 million for everything else.
And that's the third line in your chart, yes. Isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That provides you the single largest revenue savings.
Yes, Chris, for a clarification. Yep. So instead of going 40, 20, 10, it goes...
40, 10.
40, 10, 10, or 40, 10.
40, 10.
Okay.
Falls into the 10.
Yes.
Yeah. Other things on this issue? Now, this is an item that you vetted at Representative Vance.
Yes, I just am curious, Mr. Director, has this proposal made its way out into your applicant pool, and if so, are you rehearing things back about how many folks aren't going to show up as a result of this proposal or may not show up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vance, we haven't heard specifically how many people won't show up. I have heard a lot of concern about this provision, as I have about most of the others.
Yes, please. The reduction is from basically $11 million down to 5 is what is happening. Is that correct?
In terms of the credit, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vance, that's correct.
Correct. So that would have And I'm just curious, are the folks that you're hearing from mostly wind operations, or are they others?
Mr. Chairman, represents mostly wind. We do have some, we do get some cogeneration projects and potentially some biomass projects that could be affected by this, because they typically can run anywhere from $5 to $15 million of cost, so they would be impacted. But it is primarily in the wind area that would have the most impact in terms of number of projects, probably.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for my clarification, the cogeneration and the biomass projects that you reference, could you describe those projects a little bit more? Are those the kinds of projects that, say, for example, a mill might use to use some of its waste to also generate some of its power and heat, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, exactly, that's correct. And those costs would be reduced in terms of maximum eligible cost to $10 million and the maximum credit to $5 million, even if their costs were more than the $10 million. Some of those fall below that $10 million, but we do have some that go above.
Please.
And to the extent that you're familiar with these facilities, since I don't think we have anybody from them here, would this impact whether or not these kinds of cogeneration facilities get built, or will they get built anyway and there will just be additional costs to that facility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, I think that's the $64,000 question. And I think it depends on each individual circumstance. I suspect there will be some that don't go forward or get delayed, and there will be some that are able to go ahead, but they might have some impact on their financing, and that could affect the size of the facility they put in, for example. Or we do think there will be some impact, and that's why there's the revenue savings.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The federal government has made some recent changes. Is this going to offset or soften some of this impact?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, that is correct, both in the stimulus package and in legislation that was passed by Congress at the end of last year. There are some continuing incentives for renewable energy. I think those will help, but I don't know how the overall impact. I don't think it will. You know, previously, people could take advantage of both state and federal tax credits. So when you reduce the state tax credit, it does reduce the amount of incentive.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Of course. But the amount of the increase in the federal incentive should have some offsetting impact, and I know this is an evolutionary thing, and it seems like every day there's a new twist on the stimulus packages. Has the department had an opportunity to run those numbers yet?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, not in any great detail, and in some cases they were existing federal credits that were given long-term extensions, say for the production tax credit for renewable energy and the investment tax credit for solar energy, which are probably the two most important that our constituents use as well. Those weren't increased, they were continued, which gives important certainty instead of being on a year-to-year basis. There are some additional credits, though, also, that were created both for individuals and businesses, and those will have some impact. I don't think they're as big as those two in terms of the overall impact.
I don't think we have. Yeah. Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify if this amendment would move in the direction of making this more of a manufacturing incentive and less of a production incentive. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I think in terms of volume of applications, the overwhelming volume will be smaller businesses for energy efficiency projects and small renewable resource things like solar rooftop projects. I hope and I think that we will still see the large renewable energy projects, large wind, the large biomass and cogeneration. We may not see as many or as quick as we would have otherwise. But I think...
Did that answer my question?
I think we will continue to see most of these projects.
Okay. That's a good answer. Thank you very much.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Can we move on?
The last amendment that you have before you is the dash six. And this is another one that it helps to line up with the bill to see exactly what it does. The first change for the dash six is on page one. And in lines 12 and 13, section 2, sub 2A, says the applicant has, the bill currently says the applicant has complied with all state and local requirements for licenses and permits required for this facility. And there was some question of whether or not that was logistically possible for the applicant to have all of those prior to preliminary certification. There could be cases where final certification or that the product has to be, the facility has to be built. So it changes that language to the applicant has applied for all licenses and permits required by state or local law for the facility. So that's that change there. The next change is on page 2, line 8. And it inserts language so that where it now says, sub 5 reads, the State Department of Energy may condition the granting and so forth, would now read, the State Department of Energy and may not issue a certificate under ORS 469.215, I believe that's the final certification,
right,
for a large facility unless the applicant has been issued all permits and licenses required by state or local law for the facility, period. The department may condition the granting, and you get into the language that currently exists in the bill.
I see. Yeah, this is an insert.
It's an insert, yeah. Yes. An insert between the words energy and
may. Yeah.
So that five becomes kind of two pieces. And then the last piece, and Mike and I were talking about this beforehand, in line 10, the existing language in the bill says that the Department of Energy may condition the granting on the applicant continuing to meet the requirements of subsection 2. Subsection 2 is the A, B, and C that was amended earlier. And under the existing bill, Department may condition the final certification upon all three of those conditions, the sub A, sub B, and sub C. What in the dash 6, that line 8 does is remove the ability for the department to condition the final certification of that sub C. The energy may no longer allow that, and that's the continuous operation for at least 5 years. So there's some question about whether or not that... about that policy, and I don't know if Mike.
Right. Mr. Chairman, if I could add to Chris's explanation on the permit aspect, often we get applications at a very preliminary stage in terms of the planning, so the developer knows whether his project will qualify and for how much. And he may just be beginning the permit process, but with these changes, then we could condition the final certificate on receiving the permits, in fact, not issue it until they receive their permits and then require compliance as part of a condition. And this last point that Chris mentioned, neither of us could figure out why that was added, because we do, I think, if you adopt 3411, you want the ability to assure the five-year operation based on the discussions that we've had previously. And I don't know if legislative council felt that that's just self-enforcing or what, but it seems like you would not want, I guess I would recommend you not include that last line 8 of dash 6, but otherwise I think this does what we intended regarding permits.
Okay. Questions, comments, thoughts on the dash 6? This is more than nature of a technical fix. I think I agree with your comment on line 8 of the amendment. I think that ought to be just left out. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That line, well, it's line 16 on page 1, but it's paragraph 2C. That is going to be a challenge for the department, isn't it, to figure out how they're going to establish that they're going to stay in continuous operation for 5 years?
Mr. Chairman, again, this only applies to the large facilities. So I think it's a small number, and I think that's something that we can make workable, along with the other provisions in 3411.
Well, and I think all this does is make it clear that the clawback provision applies to failure to keep it open for 5 years. If we omit line 8 of the amendment. Otherwise, I think it's ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
please,
I'm just struck by the challenge that this places upon the department to establish that a facility will continue to operate for 5 years into the future. And it looks as though we're setting the bar pretty high, and that's going to be restrictive as to who it is that can comply for these larger projects, and maybe that's what we want. But it's going to be interesting 3 or 4 years into one of these things when the thing does fail, and we come back to the director and say, how come it's not still in business?
Maybe you could help us with this one by talking a little bit about how you would go about determining whether, in your judgment, the plant is going to still be operating in 5 years.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bentz, because it's a small number and these are high-profile projects, generally we know if they're operating or not. And we've had a couple of situations, one where a company, and it was actually not a wind turbine, it was a cogeneration facility. Company went bankrupt, went out of business. I mean, getting a clawback is not going to be very effective. In another case, the company simply closed that mill and continued in operation in other mills. So there the state's investment was lost by a corporate decision, basically, that which may make perfect business sense, but the question is, do you want the value of the state's investment there lost? And that's what this provision would again give some certainty that the state's investment is producing results.
Yes, Representative
Pence. Would it help the department if the standard read in line 11, paragraph 2, unless the applicant establishes, to the satisfaction of the department, because I guess it's implicit that we have to satisfy, the applicant has to satisfy the department, but this established standard suggests one of almost complete certainty. And I don't think it can be done. I wonder if you don't want some flexibility there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, if I'm following you, I think that would be fine. Maybe we could work with staff on some language there.
But the question, of course, is whether, as a policy matter, we want to allow the department to have less than absolute certainty that it's going to continue in business for 5 years. And what I'm saying is, I don't know how anyone can give you that assurance.
Mr. Chairman, you mean in advance?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Now I follow you, and I think you're right. I think the condition then is important, so that if the certificate is conditioned on operation for 5 years, and if they don't, then consequences occur. Then we can take action. I think that makes sense.
Well,
you're looking at a different piece of the issue, aren't you?
Well, Chair, I'm looking at 2C, which says the department may not issue a certification unless the applicant establishes that the facility will be in continuous operation for at least 5 years. Those are pretty clear standards, and if someone wanted to challenge the department's decision, it would be very easy to do it, because I don't know how you can promise that they're going to be in business for 5 years.
I see your point. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pence, I think that's a good point, that as long as we have the conditioning authority, then I think some language there on...
Do you think the state might get sued by somebody who didn't want the project to go forward.
Mr. Chair, they could. But I'm more interested in the committee here telling the director that we're not establishing that high a bar or that we are. I believe they deserve, it deserves that kind of direction from us.
I think it's clear that he needs the authority to turn down a project which, in his opinion, is not likely to be operating in 5 years, or is probably not going to be operating in 5 years, because it is a fact, isn't it, that you get applications from people who are less than ideally capitalized.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That is correct.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After that last remark, I'm not sure. I kind of lost my train of thought with that remark. Where was I going? Come back to me. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't
throw up his mojo.
Interrupt your train of thought, Representative Pant.
The flip side of what you just said would be that the applicant would establish to the satisfaction of the department, because that indeed would give the department the flexibility it might need. There would not have to be absolute certainty, but you could then establish by rule what degree of certainty you do require.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pence, I think that would be very workable.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, so that's one we ought to look at for... yes, Representative Riley, you've thought of that again. Yes.
What I was trying to ascertain is what happens... these are five-year credits that we're extending, and they get sold, and the company goes out of business in 2.5 years. What's the procedure? What happens to those credits?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, we had extensive discussion of this issue in the 2008 changes, and there was language that was added to protect the purchasers of the credit, because we want the transferability market not to be jeopardized. So the state's recourse, and we would be working with Department of Revenue, and primarily be the Department of Revenue, I think, that would take action, would be the recourse against the original applicant.
If they're still in existence.
If they're still in existence, that's correct, or whatever options they have there. So
I found a way to get some money.
We may end up owning a defunct plant.
Yeah, I think I just found a way to make a lot of money.
I refer you to Section 4 on page 3 of the bill, because I think that statute is contained there, along with one little change that we're proposing in it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Other questions on the Dash 6? Other issues on the Dash 6? We have a couple of more amendments coming. We have another work session scheduled on this bill on Thursday of next week. Stay tuned for the exciting sequel.
Can't wait.
Anything else this morning?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I could just add on this chart, the first line, which we really didn't talk about, that's our estimates of House Bill 3411 as written without amendments. So the other amendments that we've discussed are additive in terms of the reduced revenue impact, and if our estimates are accurate or reasonably accurate, and you adopted all of these, this would head off the significant revenue impact increase that's projected for 2009-11 in the current tax expenditure report. That would keep the program pretty close to the same level of revenue impact that we have now.
And this is considerably more than the revenue impact that we anticipated with the 2007 bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Again, even with these changes.
It is, and it reflects upon the success of the program with the projects, but also maybe too successful. But it's what we wanted to see, but it does have a revenue impact.
Yes. Well, I suspect that if Representative Buckley and Senator Carter were looking at this, they would be pleased with this part of it, probably not so pleased if we had the entire revenue impact of the whole program on the chart. Anything else on this morning? And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3411. We're finished for today. Yes, committee's adjourned. See you Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Day off.